A federal grand jury in Detroit today charged the 13 top leaders of the Weathermen with plotting to bomb public buildings in Chicago, Detroit, New York, and Berkeley, California. The Weathermen are the militant faction of the Students for a Democratic Society. Only one of the 13 is now in custody.
At 7:30 this morning, KPFK received a call from a woman identifying herself as a member of the Weather Underground.
Hello. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Freaks are revolutionaries, and revolutionaries are freaks. If you want to find us, this is where we are. In every tribe, commune, dormitory, farmhouse, barracks, and townhouse, where kids are making love, smoking dope, and loading guns, fugitives from American justice are free to go. Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
The FBI said the Weather Underground organization, which took credit for the bombing, is the same radical group which was responsible for the bombing of the U.S. Capitol in 1971 and the Pentagon in 1972. But federal officials don't really know much about the group, which is believed to have between 20 and 30 members.
My name is Bernadine Dorn, and I was part of the Weather Underground from, well, it's hard to say when it started, 1970 to 1980. It's underground for 11 years.
There's no way to be committed to nonviolence in the middle of the most violent society that history's ever created. I'm not committed to nonviolence in any way.
I'm a teacher now in a community college, and my students will occasionally bring up the war in Vietnam and ask me what my involvement was. And I'll say, well, I helped found an organization whose goal was the violent overthrow of the government of the United States. And people would... My students will look at me as if I'm from another planet.
This system is going to be overthrown. It's going to mean a fight. And it's going to mean a lot of white people risking a lot of things when they finally join on the side of the black people and the people of Vietnam and around the world who have already begun the fight.
I'm not going to tell you, oh, I walked in here this day and put a bomb here, or I made this here, or I blew up this car, or I held up this bank. I mean, there were armed robberies. There were all armed robberies, terrorism. You know, there's all kinds of things that went down that are illegal. So I tell you that we did them, but I'm not going to tell you which ones I did or who did what, because I just can't do that.
My name's David Gilbert. I'm now in Comstock Prison doing a life bid. In terms of mistakes we made, I'm willing to take responsibility, pay a price. I really haven't complained too much about my own personal situation. But was I fighting for a just cause? Well, that's the motivation. Was there a need to do something about what was going on? Yes, there was.
Through the path of 21, it killed the real criminals, power to the people.
.232 GIs killed and 900 wounded makes one of the heaviest weeks of the Vietnam War. And it is not a week, is just over 2 days, the past 2 days, two of the worst we have known in Vietnam.
Our country was murdering millions of people. Actually, the number is somewhere between 3 and 5 million people. This revelation was more than we could handle. We didn't know what to do about it. It was too great a fact. Every second of my life from 1965 to 1975, I was always aware that our country was attacking Vietnam. I could be up in the mountains, I'd be thinking about the war in Vietnam. I could be taking an acid trip, and I'd be thinking about the war in Vietnam.
My brother was drafted. My brother was in the service. So it wasn't something that that was abstract. It was something that was concrete and affected us personally and directly.
Raising total U.S. combat fatalities in this country's longest war to 30,057. The U.S. command...
To really see that these were real people with mothers and fathers and children, brothers and sisters, and they were being killed or maimed or destroyed, then opposing the war, became something that was urgent and immediate.
Reported 150 battle deaths.
I want to make it very clear that I'm going to continue with all of my might, with all of my energy, and with all of my action to oppose that abominable, evil, unjust war in Vietnam.
The marches on Washington were up to 500,000, a million, and those weren't really slowing down the United States' effort. It intensified. As the mass movement in the United States got bigger and bigger, it got worse and worse.
The war was escalating, the murder was escalating, and it was all being done in our names. And so the sense was that we had to do whatever we had to do in order to stop the war.
Opposition to the war in Vietnam on the campuses and also in the nation. However, under no circumstances will I be affected, whatever, by it.
We petitioned, we demonstrated, we sat in. I was willing to get hit over the head. I did. I was willing to go to prison. I did. To me, it was a question of what had to be done to stop the much greater violence that was going on.
As President Kennedy said, those who make peaceful revolution impossible only make violent revolution inevitable.
This nation is in a state of turmoil perhaps unparalleled in our history. Poverty amidst wealth, widespread racism, and bewilderment over a strange war are the seeds of the revolution. Nurturing these seeds are a coalition of dedicated revolutionaries working to exploit our weaknesses for the ultimate destruction of the United States system of government as we know it.
These racist Gestapo pigs have to stop brutalizing our community, or we're going to take up guns, we're going to drive them out.
If you look back at it and see a bunch of crazy young people roaming around trying to tell people that the revolution is coming. It seems totally insane, and in some ways it was totally insane, but it fit into a period of revolution in the whole world. It seemed to me that we were entering an incredible period of revolution, and I didn't want to miss that. I wanted to be part of it.
We're in a revolution. Don't ever say we're going into a revolution. We're in a revolution. Now the question is, who's going to win it?
Toward the end of 1968, I had really decided that I was committed to being a part of what I thought was going to be a really serious and ongoing rebellion, upheaval, that had the potential of not just ending the war, but of really overthrowing the capitalist system and put in its place something much more humane.
Weatherman was one of the factions into which the militant student organization, SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, split at its 1969 annual convention.
What press are you with?
What?
WGM. WGM? Okay, well, if you don't stop taking pictures now, we're not going to lie you into the convention, friend.
In June of 1969, the organization Students for a Democratic Society held its annual convention at the Coliseum in Chicago.
One of the leaders of the SDS, Bernadine Dorn, who identified herself as a national secretary, said she wanted no vultures inside, vultures meaning the press.
You're going to have to register like everyone else.
What's that going to cost?
There's a $25 fee for the regular bourgeois press and regular registration for underground revolutionary press.
That's the 12 o'clock thing you talked about.
No.
By 1969, Students for a Democratic Society was one of the leading anti-war organizations, with over 100,000 members on campuses around the country.
The SDS has promised to brief the press daily.
Its annual convention was a national news story. But it had not always been so. Founded in relative obscurity in the early 1960s, SDS drew its inspiration from the nonviolent civil rights movement. SDS changed radically over the next several years. As the Vietnam War grew, students joined SDS by the thousands, and it began to be taken seriously as a national organization. Yet despite its strength, at the 1969 convention in Chicago, SDS was in crisis. Many members felt that years of nonviolent protest had done little or nothing to stop the war and change American society. They were desperate, and in the Chicago Coliseum, the organization consumed itself in strife and power struggles.
No one can understand the degree of disunity, factionalism, and anarchy that exists within the Students for a Democratic Society until the radicals get together for a convention. It is, said one old SDSer, like a children's crusade gone mad.
Out of the ashes of SDS, a faction called the Weathermen took control of the organization.
They picked up the apparatus of the organization and the name of the organization, and they walked away with it. I mean, it was organizational piracy.
The Weathermen were some of the stars of the student left. Bernadine Dorn was a lawyer and national secretary of SDS. Mark Rudd was famous for leading demonstrations that had shut down Columbia University a year earlier.
They had the Bonnie and Clyde factor working for them. That, you know, and like Bonnie and Clyde, they were, you know, many of them were attractive personally. They were into youth exuberance, sex, drugs. They wanted action. They wanted to kick ass.
Well, that's enough.
We wanted to become communist cadre, completely committed to the revolution.
I was going to do whatever I had to do to be able to be part of it.
The Weathermen took their name from the Bob Dylan lyric, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows," by which they meant anyone could see world revolution was imminent. Third world revolutionaries and militant groups in America, like the Black Panthers, would soon overthrow the American government. They argued that SDS had to join this worldwide revolution by organizing white kids to begin fighting.
White youth must choose sides now. We must either fight on the side of the oppressed or be on the side of the oppressor.
The Weather people's ideas about revolution and communism were kindergarten ideas. So it was kind of, we're going to go it alone. There's a revolution in process. Join us. That's it. That's basically what they were saying. Join us or fuck you.
It was infuriating and depressing. And I sat in a state of horror watching the Weathermen running away with the student left.
In the summer of 1969, several hundred weathermen moved into collective houses in cities around the country to put the group's politics into action.
We're building a revolutionary movement that will fight the internal army, which is the police force. Yes, more physical contact is necessary. Whatever it takes, we'll do by any means possible.
The general idea was that working class youth outside the colleges would be more revolutionary than the students at the colleges. Of course, that's who we were. So the summer of 1969 was seen as a time when we would move off campuses, establish ourselves in working class neighborhoods, organizing among working class youth.
And so I went first to Detroit and then was involved in several of the summer programs. But yeah, we built collective houses, and it was this kind of intense moment of trying to transform a group of relatively privileged students into fighters and steel ourselves for what we saw was the coming upheaval.
I left graduate school, left my husband, and joined a weather collective, and ended up eating noodles with garlic butter on them every night for a month, and then oatmeal with nothing on it for three more months.
Most of us had such little experience with violence and so little relationship to violence, and it led really relatively sheltered lives. And as I said, for my first 7 years of activism, I was philosophically a pacifist. That to me, there was an aspect of what we did that was psyching ourselves up to make the jump over this hurdle from sort of a more comfortable middle class life.
We developed all kinds of our own repertoire of psychological tricks, like something called the gut check, where we'd challenge each other to be more violent and to be therefore more revolutionary, or to be more disciplined, to give up our bourgeois luxuries.
Jesus, sometimes they'd just go all night and they'd pick out someone. It was, to me, it was just too cultish. There would be people would go on and on about, well, first of all, there was smash monogamy. You know about that. You couldn't have monogamous relationships.
It was a moment of extreme sexual experimentation. Group sex, homosexuality, casual sex hookups were all tried as we attempted to break out of the repression of the past into the revolutionary future. As with so much in my life, I needed a theory rationalizing what we were doing. I argued publicly that since sex was the ultimate intimacy in human relations, we were building political collectives bonded with this intimacy among all members, not between monogamous couples. I remember one ride from Chicago to Detroit, in which all 14 or so of us writhed naked on the floor of the van while hurtling down the interstate, legs, arms, genitals, interlocked, with no particular identity attached. A strange, truly disconnected feeling.
Was our slogan. Our strategy was that we would make the war visible in the United States, that people couldn't just ignore it, that it would be here.
So-called SDSers came through, broke windows, smashed things, passed out leaflets, stormed through the place.
Violence can mean a lot of different things. We felt that doing nothing in a period of repressive violence is itself a form of violence. That's really the part that I think is the hardest for people to understand. That if you sit in your house and live your white life and go to your white job and allow the country that you live in to murder people and to commit genocide, and you sit there and you don't do anything about it, that's violence.
This conference was initially called to talk about our national...
One of the first things the weathermen did in the summer of 1969 was to announce that they would hold a huge demonstration called the Days of Rage in Chicago that fall. The weathermen made it clear that at the demonstration, tens of thousands of protesters would violently confront police.
The Days of Rage was an attempt to break from the norms of kind of acceptable theater of here are the anti-war people, containable, marginal, predictable, and here's the little path they're going to march down, and here's where they can make their little statement. We wanted to say no. What we're going to do is whatever we had to do to stop the violence in Vietnam.
We had done lots of build-up on college campuses in the East and in the Midwest, and we had been told by our what you might call regional cadre, the leaders of the collectives, that hundreds and thousands of people from their cities would be coming. And we somehow convinced ourselves that this was the case.
Black people are fighting, brown people are fighting, Vietnamese people are fighting. It's now time for young people and working people in this country, for a white movement, a revolutionary movement, to begin to fight.
So that first night, it was a collision with reality. It really was a hard collision with reality because we had expected hundreds, maybe thousands of kids to be here in the park. And I looked and we had maybe 150, maybe 250 kids. We had a small bonfire, and I felt, we are really in trouble. How are we going to get out of this? I remember a kind of a secret feeling that I wish somebody would come along and rescue us from what we were about to do.
Last night, they armed themselves with sticks and chains and rocks and surged through the streets of the Gold Coast on Chicago's north side to carry the fight to the enemy, the rich.
So we thundered out of the park, about 10 or 12 abreast, and we headed down this way. And the first building we came to was a bank, and we trashed every window in the bank. All glass, big plate glass windows, inviting, and that was like the signal. That was like Pavlov's bell.
It seemed to be violence for violence' sake, with the radicals making no specific demand.
Yeah. At about this point, at State and Division, we saw a serious barricade, several police cars, a real mass presence, and we had no out at that point, so we just swarmed into it, and there was a terrible fight right here.
Police generally acted with restraint, but three people were wounded by police gunshots.
Last night was the beginning for us. The ruling class in their gold coach decadence will walk their streets a little less secure tonight. If they hadn't dug it before, they'd better dig it now. They are the enemy.
The Weatherman SDS has been trying to give the impression that the Black Panthers are on their side, but the Panthers deny this.
We believe that the Weatherman action is anarchistic, opportunistic, individualistic, it's chauvinistic, it's custeristic, and that's the bad part about it. It's custeristic in that its leaders take people into situations where the people can be massacred, and they call it revolution. And it's nothing but child's play, it's folly. We think these people may be sincere, but they're misguided, they're muddleheads, and they're scatterbrains.
Weatherman has totally distorted the concept of militancy. They see it as attacking the people. We're trying to ally with working people, and they're out attacking them. You know, so it's a very simple thing. I mean, police couldn't do a better job. You know, I tend to think that their purpose is just to make the name of SDS a dirty name, and they've managed to do a pretty good job of that.
At that point, after the days of rage, there was a sense that we were pretty isolated and pretty marginal. And what we concluded, I think people drew different conclusions from the event. One set of conclusions was that the rest of the country was hopelessly bought off and horrible, and that we were virtually acting alone in concert with the Third World uprisings. So we felt pretty grim and pretty determined at the same time that we were going to see this thing through.
I think there were probably fairly sophisticated people in the government who felt that in some ways the Weathermen were a gift, because from their point of view, the worse the better. That is, the more militant and disruptive the anti-war people, the more support would flow to Nixon as a pillar of strength and sanity against them.
Violence in America today is not caused by the war. It's not caused by repression. There is no romantic ideal involved. Let's recognize these people for what they are. They're not romantic revolutionaries. They're the same thugs and hoodlums that have always plagued the good people.
I joined the FBI in 1969. And frankly, coming from my background, there were very few things, if any, that were more honorable. I was assigned to the Squad 47, more commonly known as the Weatherman Squad. With respect to the Weatherman, we had to decide whether or not these were real serious threats to the internal security of the United States. Were they really going to bomb public buildings and try to throw over the government, or were they just a bunch of talkers? And as they progressed, they earned the respect of the Bureau, respect, I say, in terms of being a potent threat.
The police harassment crescendoed. Our apartments were regularly ransacked. Our cars vandalized. Our comings and goings monitored and recorded. We began to vary our meeting and sleeping patterns after the pigs broke down the door of a fifth-floor walk-up after midnight, terrorized three comrades, and hung Terry upside down by his ankles out the window. It was all bad, of course, but we knew too that even here, we were enjoying the privilege of our skin. We were being pursued and beaten, true. But our Black Panther comrades were being targeted and assassinated.
Once Richard Nixon was elected president and was inaugurated in January of 1969, we were targeted, bam, 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 by a very sophisticated, advanced counterintelligence program, at the same time by very crude and violent police.
This pattern of harassment is going on against the Black Panther Party across the country. On Friday, the Watts office of the Black Panther Party was bombed and demolished. Last week, the Des Moines office was bombed. They can't stop anything we're doing as a legitimate political organization. So they come in and shoot us and shoot tear gas in office and drag people off to jail like they've lost their mind.
Clearly, the FBI had decided by the end of 69 the Black Panther Party was going to be wiped out. It took a little longer, but that was the approach.
The SDS National Office was located just a few blocks down Madison Street from the Panther Chicago office, and we worked very closely with them.
I got to know some of the members of the Black Panther Party, and particularly Fred Hampton.
Because we don't think that people that found...
He was a wonderful speaker, and every time he would speak in Chicago, there would be huge crowds. And he inspired people tremendously. And I believe that's why he had to be killed by the United States. They knew that he was one of those people who could be a leader on a very important, profound, and wide level. And they set out to kill him, and they did it. And it's been documented.
So we say, we always say the Black Panther Party, that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary.
In Chicago today, two Black Panthers were killed as police raided a Panther stronghold.
Police arrived at Fred Hampton's West Side apartment at 4:45 this morning. They had a search warrant authorizing them to look for illegal weapons. The state's attorney's office says that Hampton and another man were killed in the 15-minute gun battle which followed.
The pigs murdered our deputy chairman Fred Hampton while he lay in bed. They're alive. They're arguing to the people who can't bear up to the evidence that we have that they murdered our deputy chairman in cold blood as he lay in his bed asleep.
The Panther Party organized tours of the apartment that they were in when they were murdered. And I went with a group of people from the SDS National Office, which is a couple of blocks away.
Don't touch nothing, don't move nothing, we want to keep everything just the way it is.
It was a scene of carnage. It was a scene of war. You see this door ridden with bullets, not little bullet holes, but shattered.
The room where the first brother, Mark Clark, was murdered at.
You walk through a living room into the bedroom, and there's a mattress soaked in his blood, red blood down the floor.
Anyone who went through that apartment and examined the evidence that was remaining there could come to only one conclusion, and that is that Fred Hampton, 21 years old, and a member of a militant, well-known militant group, was murdered in his bed, probably as he lay asleep.
This blatant act of legitimatized murder strips all credibility from law enforcement. In the context of other acts against militant blacks in recent months, it suggests an official policy of systematic repression.
We felt that the murder of Fred required us to be more grave, more serious, more determined to raise the stakes. And not just be the white people who wrung their hands when black people were being murdered.
It's 2.5 weeks since Fred Hampton was murdered by the pigs who own this city. And for people to be able to enjoy Christmas time in this country without remembering and without making a choice about the struggle that's going on in the world, without taking action about a blatant murder that takes place in the city against a revolutionary black leader, is an obscenity.
When Fred was killed, I felt that this was the true kind of exposure of state power. This was really the way America was. It was willing to kill and murder, not just thousands of miles away, but right on the west side of Chicago, if it felt its power slipping at all. The mood was a mood that kind of ricocheted between determination and despair. There was a real sense that things were going to get pretty bad, and that the killing of Fred was emblematic of things getting pretty bad, and that none of us imagined that we were going to live through it. We all felt that we were kind of biting our lip and getting ready for a serious confrontation.
December 1969, the month that Fred Hampton was killed, was a moment of intense violence and despair in America. For many young people, the hope and idealism of the 60s died that month at the Altamont Speedway in California. A concert that was supposed to have been the West Coast version of Woodstock turned into a nightmare of bad drugs and violence. The concert fell apart when the Hells Angels killed a man in front of the stage as the Rolling Stones played. That same month, Charles Manson and his followers were a top news story. They too signaled the end of the 60s and were the ugliest possible expression of the zeitgeist. Acid-crazed hippies committing a string of random violent murders. And in the same month, Life magazine published these photographs taken while American soldiers massacred hundreds of unarmed Vietnamese civilians in the village of My Lai. It was the first time that many Americans had seen such disturbing images of the war.
The Vietnam War had made us crazy. It was sort of a mass mania driven by the United States bombing of Vietnam, among other things, and it just fed on itself. And you know, when you feel that you have right on your side, you can do some horrific things.
We figured out how to use guns and how to use bombs. I mean, we taught ourselves, we trained ourselves how to do it. At the same time, the organization was unable to resolve the question of how militant, how far would we go. Some people felt, literally, that the bigger the mess we could make, the better. That is, that whatever it cost, whatever, you know, destructive kinds of activity we could do against the U.S. government, the better.
At that point in our thinking, there were no innocent Americans, at least not among the white ones. They all played some part in the atrocities of Vietnam, if only the passive roles of ignorance, acquiescence, and acceptance of privilege. All guilty. All Americans were legitimate targets for attack. We wanted this country to taste a tiny bit of what it had been dishing out. Just like the passive Americans we derided, I acquiesced to this terrible, demented logic. Not only was I willing to take the risks and suffer the consequences, but more importantly, I was overwhelmed by hate. I cherished my hate as a badge of moral superiority.
The townhouse was part of a small autonomous group in New York City that was being led by Terry Robbins.
Terry, more than probably anyone else, represented the view that it was too late for any kind of reconciliation inside this country, and that the best that we could do was to bring about a catastrophic series of actions that would get the attention of the world.
The group that was led by Terry in that house on West 11th Street was building the bomb. They had decided to set off the bomb at a non-commissioned officer's dance at Fort Dix. The idea being that there are no innocent in this war of aggression.
What we wanted to do here was deliver the most horrific hit that the United States government had ever suffered on its territory. We wanted to light it up. Our slogan was bring the war home, and we really wanted to give the United States and the rest of the world a sense that this country was going to be completely unlivable if the United States continued in Vietnam, and that was the goal of this group.
I think what has to be stared at is that they brought themselves, they were not brought, they brought themselves to that point.
To what point?
To the point at which they were ready to be mass murderers. This is mass murder we're talking about. They came to this conclusion, which is the conclusion that was come to by all the great killers, whether Hitler or Stalin or Mao, that they have a grand project for the transformation and purification of the world. And in the face of that project, ordinary life is dispensable. They joined that tradition.
On March 6, 1970, as the Weatherman Group on West 11th Street put the final touches on the bomb, there was a short circuit in the wiring, and the device accidentally exploded.
An expensive townhouse in New York's Greenwich Village was destroyed by three explosions, which killed at least three people.
The police still only know a part of the story. What they still have to find out is a good deal more about the extent of the bomb plot and the extent to which the student protesters of the 60s have turned into more serious revolutionaries using far more lethal weapons.
One body was identified as that of SDS member Theodore Gold. The second dead man has not yet been identified. A third victim was identified as 28-year-old Diana Outen, a member of the SDS Weatherman faction. She was the daughter of one of the richest men in the small town of Dwight, Illinois.
When he heard the news of his daughter's death, James Outen, a local banker and former Republican member of the Illinois House, cut short a vacation in London and hurried home.
I've been asked how I would advise other parents, and I've answered that I have no advice at all. I wouldn't know how to advise myself. I'm looking for guidelines myself from somebody else.
I was in Denver. We had a collective there. I heard something on the radio. We were actually driving to the mountains to do target practice. I heard something on the radio about, and it was staticky, about somebody Gold was killed in an explosion in New York City. Later, I got a call saying that it had been our people. And I would say that that's the one point in my life where I was overwhelmed by the heaviness of it. That was a really difficult loss.
When the townhouse went up, it was at that point that the FBI knew that it was in a battle, and that these were truly committed revolutionaries who planned on doing a lot more to achieve the violent overthrow of this government than just talking about it. These weathermen people were actually randomly bombing and intended to kill people. At that point, pressure came all the way from the White House to catch these people. It was very, very high pressure.
When this explosion happened, a group of us disappeared from sight, and that was really the official beginning of what came to be called the Weather Underground.
Anyone who does have any information on where these people are located should immediately contact the FBI.
I cut my hair. That was hard for me. I had long hair down to my waist for a lot of years. And so preparing to go underground, I cut my hair off. And I went back to say goodbye to my family on the farm. My family's a very strong, cohesive, extended Jewish family. And they were just hurt and confused. I remember feeling that unless I really made a break with my family, I wasn't going to be able to be free to do what I'd have to do as a revolutionary. It was a lot of hurt to my family, my parents, but I was going to do it. I just wasn't going to let anything hold me back.
I knew we were going underground, but of course I didn't know how precipitously it would happen. My parents weren't political. They didn't have any way in which to put that into a framework. But I took a last trip to visit them, and I didn't want to scare them more than they were already worried, but I did want them to think back and remember what I said, that I didn't want to hurt them and that I loved them. So I, you know, have a vivid memory of saying goodbye to them at the airport and walking away and turning around and looking at them waving at me and knowing that I wasn't going to see them again.
Shortly after the townhouse explosion, the leaders of the Weather Underground gathered at a house on the coast of Northern California to figure out what had gone wrong.
We took a deep, deep breath and a big step back from the precipice. There was a huge debate about what had happened, and the conclusion that the majority of us came to was that a terrible error had been made, that it was definitely wrong to unleash indiscriminate violence against ordinary people, that was actually terrorism.
I wasn't in the leadership. You know, I wasn't making decisions, but I still feel responsible because I didn't say at any point, wait a second. You know, if we're going to talk about waging war against, bring the war home, wage war against in the belly of the mother country and all that stuff, we better know what we're talking about before we start actually taking actions. And, you know, I regret that to this day.
We were very careful from the moment of the townhouse on to be sure we weren't going to hurt anybody. And we never did hurt anybody. Whenever we put a bomb in a public space, we had figured out all kinds of ways to put checks and balances on the thing, and also to get people away from it. And we were remarkably successful.
Our goal was to not hurt any people, and a lot of work went into that. But we wanted to pick targets that show to the public who was responsible for what was really going on.
During the early 1970s, there was a strong radical prison movement in the United States.
We are men! We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such. The entire prison populace has set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States.
one of the prison movement's leaders was George Jackson. He had become famous after publishing a bestseller. In August 1971, Jackson was killed by guards at San Quentin during an escape attempt.
Our witnesses say that George Jackson was shot in the leg, apparently went down, got up, and was running in a cross position, and was shot again.
They say that George ran for the gate with a gun in his hand. That sounds a lot like...
Say anything.
We were not unprepared for this crisis. We'd been watching the prison scene closely, after all, and had often discussed potential targets. The State Corrections Department had a suite of offices in the Ferry Building, at the edge of downtown in San Francisco. The gray prison bureaucracy was usually both anonymous and unaccountable. Flushing them out and humiliating them in their fancy digs was a proper step towards redress. We started moving people and supplies into a motel on Lombard Street on Thursday evening. Arrivals and departures from the motel were tightly rationed. We didn't want it to look like a dope dealer had set up shop. Stanley and I started working on the wiring that first night. Zeke was holed up somewhere, working on the communique, which we were all dying to see. We had the thing pretty well built, and we're testing the connections by mid-morning Friday. Nick slid the box into the airline bag, then zippered the bag shut and hung it on my shoulder. Hugs and kisses all around and out the door into the bright California sun. All of the safeguards in the world could not take the fear out of the Enterprise from this point on. Up the parcel goes, my hands to his, into the hole. One last moment of serious vulnerability. Stepping back into the main hall. All clear. Leave in opposite directions. Don't walk too fast. It's 2:30. 9.5 hours to go. We did it.
San Francisco Chronicle, August 28, 1971. The call from the young man was made to Helen Garrick, switchboard operator at the Chronicle. She kept notes on what the caller said. Quote, "There is a bomb in the Ferry Building. It will go off in 15 minutes. They're doing this in defense of Jackson. Be sure to have the Harbor Police and the City Police clear the area."
The Underground Weatherman Organization claimed responsibility for the San Francisco and Sacramento bombings, saying they were, I quote, "in outraged response to the assassination of Soledad brother George Jackson."
The bombings came just hours before Jackson's funeral at this Episcopal church in the poor black section of Oakland.
To the Jackson family.
This is the 12th communication from the Weather Underground. The history of black people in this country has been one of passionate resistance to the slave masters. All too often, they have had to wage that fight alone. Black and brown people inside the jails are doing all they can. Must they fight alone even now? White people on the outside have a deep responsibility to enter the battle at every level. We view our action as simply a first expression of our love and respect for George Jackson and the warriors of San Quentin.
We'll be right back.
Associated Press in Washington today received a 5-page typewritten letter in which an organization calling itself the Weather Underground said it had bombed the Capitol yesterday. The letter said, among other things, "We have attacked the Capitol because it is a monument to U.S. domination over the planet.
We didn't do it, but we dug it. The people who did the Capitol bombing were the Weather Underground. They bombed the Capitol to bring a smile and a wink to all the kids who hate the American government."
Sick minds, apparently, in this country who think that violence can be used to bring about social reform or change in national policy. It clearly can't, and moreover, these kinds of insane efforts hurt, not help.
When Weather first went underground in 70, the conventional wisdom that we would be rounded up within a year. You don't remember the 50s. I grew up in the 50s. Every TV program, the police or the FBI always got their man. In fact, I think there was a movie code. You couldn't show people getting away with crime. So there was a psych in the population that it was impossible to defy the FBI. Everybody on the left said, no, this is only going to last for a few months.
Underground is sort of a state of information control rather than a place. It means having a lot of control about who knows what, about who you are and where you are. So you don't have a phone in the house. All phone calls are made from phone booths. I didn't hang out in places where a lot of people from my past were going to recognize me.
It's a parallel universe. I mean, the number of times that I would run into people who should have recognized me and didn't were astronomical. Because how would they recognize you? You were underground. So you couldn't possibly be walking out of that theater because you're not here. You're invisible.
There was a leadership group, which was the Weather Bureau, that circulated around the country and would visit various collectives. I was in one of the groups, so they would visit us occasionally. I didn't know exactly what was happening in all the other areas of the country because we had a need-to-know principle, right? If you didn't have to know it, you didn't know it, and you didn't ask.
Tonight, American and South Vietnamese units will attack the headquarters for the entire communist military operation in South Vietnam.
As President Nixon continued to widen the Vietnam War, American society grew more and more polarized. For a time, the Weather Underground seemed to have its finger on the pulse of the growing counterculture. For many young people, the Weather Underground had become larger-than-life figures, outlaws in the tradition of Bonnie and Clyde or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Their successful actions only added to the mystique.
I probably pushed my nervous system as much as any human being living. I've taken LSD over 500 times.
One of the group's most high-profile actions was helping the counterculture hero Timothy Leary escape from a California prison.
I think I'm the strongest, sanest person around.
Leary was serving a 10-year prison sentence for possession of several joints. The Weather Underground was paid $20,000 for the job.
This group, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, do you know who they are? They gave us a certain amount of money to break Leary out of jail and get him out of the country. They were an drug group, mainly LSD, that had Leary as their figurehead, and they had a lot of money.
Black Panther leader Eldridge Cleaver said that LSD advocate Timothy Leary, who escaped from a California prison last month, has joined forces with him in Algeria.
I escaped with the help of the Weathermen Underground. 25 of their crack underground operators came to California for 6 weeks before my escape. And it was a very complicated operation. They not only helped us escape, they spirited us to several of their underground stations with great efficiency. We want to tell the people of the United States the Third World War has begun. Join us in the fight for freedom, because we are everywhere, and we're happy, and we're free, and we're going to make the world free.
This is the fifth communication from the Weathermen Underground. Rosemary and Tim are free and high. We are building a culture and a society that can resist genocide. It is a culture of total resistance to mind-controlling maniacs. A culture of high-energy sisters getting it on, of hippie acid smiles and communes and freedom to be the farthest out people we can be. Now we are everywhere, and next week, families and tribes will attack the enemy around the country. We are not just attacking targets. We are bringing a pitiful, helpless giant to its knees. Guard your planes. Guard your colleges. Guard your banks. Guard your children. Guard your doors.
Can you verify that the voice is that of Bernadine Dorn?
Yes, I'm her sister, and I'll verify that it's her voice.
What is your
first name? Jennifer.
How do you feel about what your sister is advocating?
I think it's right on. I think she's far out, and all weathermen are far out.
Could you explain that?
there are brothers and sisters in the underground. They're forced to be outlaws by the way the society is run, and we think they're great.
We're in Sausalito at the houseboats. It's right on the other side of Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. And we lived here when we first went underground. They were really looking for us. I was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. There were pictures everywhere and rewards everywhere and indictments falling from the sky. It was much less built up than this. For us, it was perfect. There were dropouts from all walks of life. Gay people fleeing Iowa, people fleeing the Midwest and the draft. So there was a lot of outlaw culture.
Because of the way that this country is falling apart, more and more young people are living in communal situations. More and more young people are beginning to fight the government on various levels. And so there's a huge mass of people that people who are underground fugitives can move amongst and have protection from and be with.
The weathermen were extremely bright. Many of them had access to fairly substantial amounts of money, which is the key to staying underground. We didn't get them, but we came close. It was frustrating when you wanted to catch these people as much as we did. You weren't going to catch these people in the standard FBI approach of surveilling the house the night before grandma's 50th wedding anniversary, so the fugitive comes walking in with a gift. Bang, you got him. It wasn't going to work that way. The way that we decided to do was to basically go underground in essentially the same way they did. And use some investigative techniques which were very tried and true in the National Security Division.
They did break into people's apartments and steal things, did try to plant divisive stories among people who were working in the peace movement and the anti-war movement. And I had a whole strategy that included beating people up and dangling people out of windows. And, you know, it was not just light.
I know people who have liberal political tendencies would say it's terrible. People who don't would say that, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, nothing wrong is going to happen, nothing bad is going to happen to you.
In the early 1970s, a group of radicals calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania, and made off with several boxes of files. The documents, which were leaked anonymously to the press, revealed the existence of COINTELPRO, a secret FBI program to destroy a wide range of groups that opposed the U.S. government. The Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, even Martin Luther King. By the early 1970s, COINTELPRO had been largely effective.
The movement began to devour itself. There was the absence of all the things that made the movement so powerful. Absence of trust, absence of love, absence of a sense of humor, absence of commitment, absence of this communal, we're all in this together. All that stuff seemed to have been blown apart.
In the early 70s, the psychic stress, the psychic upheaval was so intense, and the loss of ideological underpinnings and clarity about the world is so severe that many people who had come out of the New Left were in retreat.
I remember sitting on a park bench reading the newspaper, and I thought to myself, here I am sitting on a park bench doing absolutely nothing when I had been the chairman of the largest national anti-war organization in the United States, a student anti-war organization in the United States. I thought to myself, what a waste, what am I doing here?
I thought we were being reduced to a group that just put a bomb here and then a few months later put a bomb here and then put a bomb there. That seemed to me to be sort of played out. It was into how much further could we go with that? And we were increasingly being thought of sort of an isolated cult. I was feeling lonely and alienated, and I missed my girlfriend, and I just wasn't having a very good time. And the combination of the two, one day I just walked out.
During the mid-1970s, as the Black movement and the anti-war movement faded, the left branched off into a wide range of organizations and causes.
I don't remember much interest among people I knew in what the Weathermen were doing. I was around a lot of students, and there was a lot of interest in the women's movement. I mean, that had a presence, and there was certainly a lot of opposition to the war. But I don't remember anybody ever talking about the Weathermen. But in the mid-70s, the Weather Underground was a kind of reverberation in time, a kind of golden oldie.
25 people from the Weather Underground organization. We're in a house, you could call it a safe house. We're here with a group of filmmakers, and together we're going to make a film.
Here we are. The windows are boarded up. It's very awkward, and we are willing to take the risk of doing this because it seemed like we could speak to a lot of people, and we do want to do that.
How many people are in your organization?
Well, we're a very small organization relative to the task to be done, and we can't discuss exactly the size. We're small, but we don't feel weak. We want to make a revolution. We think there has to be a revolution.
From the underground, that radical left-wing group, the Weathermen, has claimed responsibility for yesterday's dynamiting of a statue of a Chicago policeman. The group promises more attacks on the establishment around the entire country starting next week. The medium for this message was a tape recording, reputedly by the fugitive Weatherman leader, Bernadine Dorn. It came by mail this morning to New York.
The group said that it planted the bomb to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the military overthrow of the Allende government in Chile.
There are 20 to 30 people in the group. We know who they are. There are federal warrants out on, I believe, 12 of them.
A dynamite explosion last night heavily damaged one floor of the Gulf Oil Corporation's Pittsburgh headquarters. No one was hurt. A radical group called the Weather Underground said it set the blast in retaliation for Gulf's policies in Portuguese Angola in Africa.
We felt that more and more people would be attracted to the revolutionary violence of the Weather Underground and of the other groups. What I began to discover was that Americans are taught again and again from a very early age that the only violence, that all violence which is not sanctioned by the government is either criminal or mentally ill. And so our violence was categorized as that, criminal and mentally ill. Violence didn't work.
And now it's winter. You feel like winter in America. Yeah, it's a time when all of the healer brothers who could help us done been killed. They put them in jails. Yeah, people know it's something wrong. Everybody ought to know when to
Good evening. A quarter century of American involvement in South Vietnam is over.
These are tonight's headlines. South Vietnam surrenders and the communists occupy Saigon. We have dramatic film of the evacuation of Americans and Vietnamese from Saigon.
The war in Vietnam was the most visible and the most palpable and the most dramatic expression of what we were opposed to. And so our unity was based on throwing our bodies into combat against the war in Vietnam. When the war in Vietnam ended, all of that unity began to unravel.
A lot of us, with the end of the war in 75, began to come up with the idea that we should come up, that it was pointless to stay underground.
It wasn't going to be as dramatic after the Vietnam War ended in 75, and there were increasing struggles about what was wrong with our direction, and I think that happened. The whole left was challenged at the end of the Vietnam War.
The end happened because Most all leftist political organizations, when they reach the point of irrelevancy, turn in on themselves, and kill each other. And that's approximately what happened.
The organization was coming apart through a variety of means, people deciding to turn themselves in, a great deal of criticism of us, of me, for the failures and weaknesses in our leadership.
People knew each other's whereabouts on a need-to-know basis. And toward the end, that became more and more restricted because everybody got more and more freaked out, paranoid, I would say, to some extent. And so I had no way. I wasn't living in a collective. I was living on my own. And what I had as a connection was meeting to meeting. We're going to meet at such and such a place at such and such a time. I raised the criticisms in a particularly sharp way at a meeting with some people in leadership, and they didn't show up for the next meeting, and then I didn't have any way to get in touch with them anymore. So it was over for me.
October 19th, 1977. Dear Dad, hello from the other side of the shadows. I don't mean to shock you, but I've been contemplating writing to you for a long time. First, the good news, which is you have a second grandson. He had a good birth, no drugs, no problems, and his mom is okay too. I've been working when I can, which is not full-time and not nearly enough to support us. Not only do I lack skills and qualifications, I also lack the references and work record fitting my age, all of which become more important with this extreme unemployment. Right now, it's hard to get a job pushing a broom if you can't prove you've been doing it for 10 years. Often I wake up and find it completely inexplicable how and why I am where I am today and disconnected from my family. As I know you won't be out here for a while, I'm finding an address where you can write me directly. Please send me your advice or reflections on what I should do.
Mark Rudd, the fugitive radical, turned himself in today to authorities in New York City after years of hiding. He was a leader of the Weather Underground back in the 60s, but he's 30 years old now, and the world has changed.
Today, Rudd came out of hiding and walked into the office of the District Attorney of New York County to give himself up.
Rudd didn't say why he gave himself up, but his father said this. He's 30 years old. You get to be too old to be a revolutionary. You have to start something else.
Even though the organization had ended and we really didn't have a strategic and political reason for staying underground, I found the idea of turning myself in revolting. And I had a baby. We had a new baby. And we immersed ourselves in a whole new life with parents and children. And moved to the East Coast and sort of started over. And Zaid was getting old enough so that it was obviously becoming complicated to never have anybody know where we lived and never have anybody come over to our house. So I came to that decision in the summer of 80, finally. And once I made the decision, it was just a matter of holding my nose and going through with the surrender.
Bernardine Dorn, the former anti-war leader and student radical, surrendered today in Chicago.
Rebellion is inevitable and continuous. Resistance by every means necessary is happening and will continue to happen within the United States as well as around the world, and I remain committed to the struggle ahead.
Excuse me.
By the end of the 70s, almost all of the members of the Weather Underground had turned themselves in. Few ended up going to prison. Ironically, the government was forced to drop most of the charges against them when it became clear how much the FBI had broken the law in pursuing the group. As the 70s drew to a close, America seemed to be falling apart. Watergate, Vietnam, and recession had sapped the country's confidence. Most Americans seemed to want to put the trauma of the previous decade behind them.
I hear a lot in the last 30 years. Nice little tree-lined street, pretty buildings. And never really gets much easier. If you think that you have the moral high ground, that's a very dangerous position, and you can do some really dreadful things. You see it with terrorists these days, you know, who think that, well, maybe Allah's on their side, or history's on their side, or whatever. They can do some things that are just completely unconscionable. They can blow up the World Trade Center, you know, they can do... They can just do horrible, horrible things. The Oklahoma City bombing. I'm sure that guy felt that he was on the side of right. You know, there may be a handful of people who agreed with him. So that is a dangerous ethical position that we fell into. That was caused, I think, a lot by the Vietnam War. I think that the Vietnam War made us all a little crazy. It's the only way I can explain it.
When I was in prison, I'd been in prison for a bit. 2 years, and I was put in isolation. And I wrote a letter to my father, and I said, either I'm really a great optimist and have just oceans of hope and joy, or I'm really stupid and too dumb to know what's happening to me. And I still feel that sometimes, because most of the movement that was committed to and really thought a revolution was going to happen in the late 60s, early 70s, has fallen by the wayside and said, oh, it's going to be eons and, you know, it's not going to happen, whatever. Not most, but a lot of people. I still have hope. I don't think we're going to have a revolution in 5 years like I did in 1970. But I definitely think that people never stop struggling and never stop waiting for the moment when they can change the things that make their lives unlivable.
I would do it again. I'd like to do it better, differently, smarter, but in a revolutionary context, if I didn't have my old parents and my young kids, I would certainly do it again. I would certainly want to be part of an emerging revolution again. It was a precious, precious opportunity. And I think we came close. I mean, I think the world came close to seeing those major changes, and I think that
makes a difference in terms of the ability of movements for change to emerge in the future. The fact that there's a history of resistance, there's a history of white people's participation in resistance, I think makes a difference to the ability of that kind of resistance to emerge again.
Do you think it will?
I think it already is.
Why have you been so reluctant to talk about your own experiences?
My mixed feelings. My feelings of guilt and shame. These are things that I am not proud of. I find it hard to speak publicly about them, you know, and to tease out what was right from what was wrong. I think that part of the Weatherman phenomenon that was right was our understanding of what the position of the United States is in the world. It was this knowledge that we just couldn't handle. It was too big. We didn't know what to do. In a way, I still don't know what to do with this knowledge. I don't know what needs to be done now. And it's still eating away at me, just as it did 30 years ago.